And the reason why we created this forum 66 weeks ago was to unite the international peace movement, to bring people together above their ideologies, above their differences, and to say we have to create true peace now or we're facing thermonuclear World War III. And I mean, a year ago, I thought that was as close as we possibly could be. And I never would have imagined that we would have come this close now. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. I'll open it up for Helga Zempel-Ruysch, who is the founder of the Schiller Institute and the initiator of the International Peace Coalition. Please go ahead, Helga.
Well, first of all, I greet all of you. And I'm very thankful that today we have quite a number of extremely important experts because it is so urgent to bring in scientific clarity into the strategic debate because we are clearly in not only in the middle of an actual or two actual regional wars, but in a pre-war situation which is dominated by information warfare, by the attempt to control the narrative. And we see many extremely worrying examples that the freedom of speech and the freedom of press is being suppressed. The result of all of that is that the population, for the most part, is in a state of confusion. Now, we are all extremely worried that the situation in Ukraine is spinning out of control. Today, there is the Rammstein Ukraine Contact Group meeting. President Zelensky is there and he is demanding that more long-range missiles should be given to Ukraine with the permission to strike territory of Russia deep inside the territory of Russia, because supposedly, the goal is still to, quote, inflict strategic defeat on Russia, which, given the fact that it's the largest nuclear power, is practically impossible without causing the destruction of the whole world. Defense Secretary Austin immediately answered Zelensky, saying, "I share your urgency. We will do everything we can." Now, while the situation in Donbas is looking quite grim for the Ukrainians, the Russians are gaining control rapidly. The situation in Kursk also is not tenable, and more drones and missiles are being sent inside Russia. Yesterday, Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Zakharova made a very strong attack, saying that London is behind the drone attacks inside Russia, and that it is London which is relentlessly striving to escalate the conflict. And then she gave a long list of examples where that has been the case in the last several years. Now, she also reminded people that on the 6th of May this year, the Russian Foreign Ministry had put out a warning saying that any British military facility and equipment on Ukrainian territory and beyond will be hit if this is not stopping. Now, on the sidelines of the Eastern Economic Forum, Zakharova also said the Europeans do not understand what they're being tracked into by the US, by the Anglo-Saxons. Now, on July 29th, Biden signed an amendment to the US-British Mutual Defense Agreement from 1958. And this new agreement removes the expiration date because there was a provision that this agreement had to be renewed every 10 years. Now, Malcolm Chalmers, the vice president of the British think tank RUSI, said this is very good because now one doesn't have to worry about changing administrations anymore, because obviously, this way, the idea is to make this agreement permanent, or in other words, Trump-proofed. Now, what is it what the Europeans are being dragged into? To find the truth is a bit like peeling an onion. Let me peel one layer. End of August, the New York Times reported that Biden had already signed in March a new US nuclear doctrine, which is completely secret. It supposedly doesn't even exist in electronic form. Only a handful of printed copies to very selective people have been given out, where it says, according to the New York Times, that the United States has to prepare for a three-front confrontation against Russia, China, and North Korea. Okay, then a couple of months later, after March in July at the NATO summit, Scholz, the Chancellor of Germany, just nonchalant announced the US made the decision to put from 2026 US middle range missiles into Germany. And that is a good decision. No debate in the Bundestag, no debate in the German public, no discussion with the European allies, unlike in 1979, when the NATO retrofitting decision was made, there was a broad discussion in the public among the allies, and four allies shared the decision together with Germany. Now, obviously, if the US puts missiles into Germany, it affects the security interests of all allies. In a discussion with military experts, I found out in the last several days that the decision to put these missiles in Germany in 26 was not made at the sidelines of the NATO summit or not even in bilateral discussions before, but the decision already was made in 2021, namely that it is part of the advanced US national system and therefore no discussion with the allies is necessary. And what this does is very obvious. It makes Germany the strategic staging ground for a confrontation between the two most powerful nuclear powers and now of a potential clash between global NATO and Russia, China, and North Korea. Let me quickly look, how did we get there? In December 2017, the US put out the US National Security Strategy, NSS, under the leadership of McMaster, who was the national security advisor at that time. And in this document, for the first time, Russia and China were named as geopolitical rivals. Now, this happened exactly 4 years after Xi Jinping had announced the new Silk Road in 2013, which, you know, had started to take on, you know, projects of development in many developing countries. And this document doesn't say that explicitly, but demands a rethinking of the policy and says that the integration of China into the WTO was a mistake and that it was necessary for the US to reassert military dominance. Shortly afterwards, on the 19th of January 2018, the Pentagon put out the National Defense Strategy, the NDS, which I think is still classified to the present day. And it demands the deterrence to be upgraded in three regions, the Indo-Pacific, Europe, and the Near East, and to modernize all weapon systems, including the nuclear one. 1 month later, on the 3rd of February in 2018, they published the Nuclear Posture Review, NPR, which called for the modernization of the triad, including the stationing of low-yield nuclear bombs on Trident submarines and other places. Now, 1 month later, President Putin, on the 1st of March 2018, announced the new nuclear systems Russia had developed, the hypersonic missiles, the Avangard, the hypersonic cruise missile Kinshal, which can go 20 Mach speed, and has very high maneuverability, and various other underwater drones and laser weapons. Shortly thereafter, the US announced the updated US space doctrine, and the commander of the US Space Command at that time, James Dickinson, said, "We will try to avoid conflict, but if it fails, we will win warfare in space." Now, all of this was closely coordinated with the British Defense Minister Mark Lancaster, said the policy of NSS, NDS, and NPR are also the policy of the British government. Now, that included Obama's pivot to Asia. And then about 3 years ago, this whole policy was upgraded by calling for a network of regional partners and allies. AUKUS was created, which first was just the United States, Great Britain, and Australia. Then the Quad system, including Japan, South Korea, India, and now talk about New Zealand joining that. And more, the idea of global NATO came to the forefront. There was a meeting between von der Leyen and Stoltenberg saying that the EU and NATO are now fully integrated and will work together. So NATO is clearly the bridge. How Europe is being dragged into the coming conflict by the United States with China, or it's supposed to be the plan. And Germany, in a typical anticipatory obedience, several weeks ago participated in a Pacific maneuver. Defense Minister Pistorius was running around in Hawaii, you know, proudly proclaiming the two little ships Germany had contributed to these war maneuvers. So, you know, this is fully in preparation. 2 days ago, Chancellor Scholz visited Todendorf, where the Iris air defense system was shown. And he said there publicly, and it was transmitted in the German TV, Russia canceled the INF treaty. Now, that is part of the narrative. It is absolutely not true. The INF, which in large part was the result of the large demonstration at the beginning of the 80s, where in the end, 1 million people took to the streets to protest against the middle-range missile deployed, the SS-20 and the Pershing 2. This was efficient because until the 5th of February 2005, under the INF Treaty, all US and Russian systems belonging to this category were destroyed. What was helpful was a unique verification system which not only could verify the existence of the systems, but also their construction and even the design in the offices where the design engineers were drawing up these plans. Now, that treaty expired in 2015. The United States waited 4 more years, and in February 2019, with 6 months lead time, the US ended the INF treaty on the 1st of August 2019. And 1 day later, on the 2nd of August, Russia said, well, if a treaty which only has two partners, if one side cancels, it's no point to keep it. But we keep a moratorium, which I think they're still keeping to the present day, not to put such missiles into place ever since. Now, the second mistake or lie or however you want to call it, Scholz pronounced in Todendorf, was that such missiles would also be deployed in Kaliningrad. And, you know, since Berlin is only 530 kilometers away, they could hit Berlin. Now, he clearly was talking about the Iskander missiles, which have a range below 500 kilometers. And how they can hit Berlin 530 kilometers away, you know, you need a special arithmetic to come to this conclusion. This is going on all the time. So there is a very simple way of solving this. Both sides should reinstitute the verification regime, which functioned so well for the whole time. Now, I want to stop here because, you know, I just wanted to say that this is not something which happened because of the Ukraine war or anything in the recent period. But the plan to contain the rise of China, I think that that is visible at least since 2017. And therefore, I think we have to have urgently a strategic debate, an inclusive debate of what kind of security system do we really need in order to preserve the existence of all of our nations? Thank you.
Thank you, Helga, for that. Next, I'd like to introduce Dr. Ted Postol. He's an MIT professor emeritus and one of the world's leading experts on nuclear weapons. In fact, I'd say the leading expert on nuclear war. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Postol.
It's my pleasure to join you, and I must say that Helga's summary is very sobering, and really all I can do is put some important technical details to it. And basically, the technical detail that is probably most important in terms of raising alarm along the lines that Helga's already raised is the program that the U.S. has for upgrading its what I would call its prompt preemption strike forces. And this is a program that focuses exclusively on ballistic missiles, which are the most rapid means of delivery of nuclear weapons against Russia and China, and also, of course, North Korea. And in a war, if you were crazy enough to get into a war that's nuclear, these weapons would be certainly the primary weapons used to try to destroy silo-based missiles that are mostly possessed by China and Russia. Now, just to give you a sense what a silo-based missile is, if we just jump to slide 5, this is a diagram of what I would call a silo-based missile. The left side, the left figure in this diagram shows a large missile, 30 meters in length and 3 meters in diameter. Weighs about 450,000 pounds. It's a very big missile, able to carry a large number of nuclear warheads. And this is a Russian missile that exists in large numbers. The figure on the right shows how this missile is protected. It's buried in the ground. The top of this elaborate structure is flush with the surface of the earth. And the rest of the missile is buried underground, and the missile sits in a capsule that is protected by concrete and reinforced steel shells. And the missile itself is on a large spring-loaded platform. And to give you a sense, the next slide just shows you what I need to use to explain this new innovation that the United States has been working on for the past 20 years in a super secret program. When I say super secret, members of the Congress were not informed of it. And in fact, the program goes against guidance that was laid down by the Congress. The shell, this gray-like cup that looks like an underground, an overturned, an upside down cup, delineates the volume, the space in which a nuclear warhead, if a nuclear warhead detonates, it will do enough, it will create enough weapons effects that it would destroy the missile in the silo, which is shown below. As you can see, the distances are 50 meters and on a side. And the silo, of course, looks very small in this diagram. What the United States has done at great cost and effort, this was not an easy program to do. So it was not incidental, and it was clearly intended for purposes of expanding the nuclear strike capability of the United States, is shown on the next slide. If you look at the inset on the left of this slide, the volume that what I call the lethal volume, which is the volume in which if a warhead detonates, the silo will be destroyed. On the with lines going from the upper left down to the ground, showing you the incoming trajectories of a relative, of a quite accurate set, quite accurate warheads. Now, the problem with this fusing is that the warheads have to reach a certain altitude and then detonate. So they detonate on a plane. So as you can see from the diagram, some warheads fall short of the lethal volume and other warheads fall long of the lethal volume. Well, with this new fuse, the new fuse has the effect of being able to collect all these warheads into the lethal volume. So this means that the percentage of warheads that would miss destroying the target is reduced drastically. The inset on the right shows roughly how this would be achieved. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to just jump to slide 10, which is just a redoing of the inset on the right. And what this shows is how this is accomplished. What happens is with the new fuse, instead of the aim point, the point where the intended warhead is aimed, the aim point is shifted from actually the silo to a little distance downrange of the silo. Now, the result of that is that warheads that would fall short of the silo can now be placed inside the lethal volume. And warheads that fall long of the silo can also be placed in the lethal volume. The way this is achieved, I'll be quick about this, but anybody who wants these diagrams can have them if they send me a note, or if the people in the peace conference want to distribute this briefing slides, I'd be happy to make them available. But if you look at the intended trajectory, if you were maybe 60 or 70 kilometers away before you arrive at the silo, you could measure the distance to the ground. And if the distance, and you know the time, and you know what the trajectory, what the intended trajectory is, so you know exactly what the altitude of the warhead should be if it's on the intended trajectory. If the warhead is higher than, if the altitude is higher than what you intended because of errors that come from various sources, you then know that the warhead is slightly higher and slightly further away from the actual detonation point you would want to achieve. And so you make an adjustment while you are outside the atmosphere to make sure that the warhead detonates inside that lethal volume. Slide 12 shows the effect of this apparently simple adjustment. This shows you the probability of kill, that is to say, destroying the silo, if you have either a conventional warhead or what I call a super fuse warhead. The blue line shows you that the probability of destroying the silo would be around 0.85 or so. That's if it had the conventional fuse. But if you had this fuse that made these adjustments, you would instead have a probability of kill better than 0.99. Now, if you wanted to achieve a probability of kill of better than 0.99, you would have to use at least two warheads with the other kind of fuse. So what you in effect are doing is doubling the firepower of your arsenal with this particular warhead, which is the 100 kiloton W-76 warheads, which is on U.S. submarines. Now, this may seem alarming, but it actually is more problematic than you even might think offhand. If we go back to slide three, we can look at the US arsenal. There we are. And we can see what I've laid out are the what I call the prompt preemptive strike forces. And the yellow, the forces that are yellow, highlighted in yellow, the warheads in yellow, there are about 1,600 of these 100 kiloton warheads which have been upgraded with this fuse. Now, all of these fuse, all of these warheads, which were not able, according to the US government planning, to destroy Russian and Chinese missiles in their underground silos, are now able to do it. So now this means that the warheads shown that are highlighted in green, which are higher yield warheads, no longer have to be used for that mission. So you have, in a sense, a giant increase in the ability to use the highest yield warheads in other missions. So just to give you an example of that, let's jump to slide 15. And when we 15 shows the high yield warhead, in this case, a Trident II 475 kiloton warhead, which are on the submarines. The submarines carry 475 kiloton warheads and 100 kiloton warheads. All those 475 kiloton warheads no longer are needed to destroy silos. So in this depiction, I show the Capitol building as if it were an underground structure, a command center. And now all these high yield warheads can be used on all kinds of other targets like command and control centers and whatever else the United States wants to destroy that are very extremely hardened. These are the kinds of upgrades that would only be done if you intended to fight and win a nuclear war, if you thought you could do that. Of course, you can't do that. In the process of fighting the nuclear war, you would destroy your own country and the other country, along with the other country that you're fighting. So, in fact, you would destroy the entire world. But so it's a fiction to think that you can fight and win a nuclear war, and it's an extraordinary delusional and counterfactual set of ideas that would lead anyone to believe you could fight and win a nuclear war. Yet the United States is putting tremendous resources into this war fighting capability. Let me just finish by making one point that I think everyone should consider. We have a couple of soldiers speaking after me, so they can, I think they'll agree with me, but if not, I would welcome their input. If you're a soldier, if you're a Russian military officer, and you're looking at an adversary who is doing all these things, you have no choice but to consider the possibility that your adversary intends to try to fight and win a nuclear war against you and intends to try to destroy a large part of your nuclear forces before you can launch them as a deterrent or in a retaliation. So in addition, of course, that particular adversary, the United States, is building missile defenses. Now, it's another story about how well those missile defenses would work. In fact, they won't work. But when you sit there as a military officer, intention plays a role in your consideration of your adversary. So if your adversary is putting these tremendous resources into doing things that look like they're aiming at fighting and winning a nuclear war with you and building missile defenses that would take advantage of their first strike against you, if it worked, of course, you have to say to yourself, what is going on with these people? What is their doctrine? What are they willing to try? And this is a very dangerous situation, especially in the case of Russia, which has a warning system that is limited in some important ways, which I won't have time to go into here, but you can find this discussed in other forums. But I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Postol. That was a terrifying presentation. And I'm sure that many of the organizers on this call, which we have nearly 350 on this call right now, will be happy to get this out. So we'll make a video.
I'll be happy
excerpt.
To.
Yeah,
that would be good.
Great. I'm already getting requests for your slides, so we'll make sure to share that with everyone.
Yes.
So we're going to make a slight adjustment to the agenda, and we're going to go to Colonel Larry Wilkerson, who's a retired U.S. Army colonel and former chief of staff of Secretary of State Colin Powell. Thank you so much for joining us, Larry Wilkerson.
Thank you for having me, Anastasia. And I won't say it's a pleasure to be with you, not after Professor Postol's presentation, which I had some inklings of, but not in the detail that he just expressed that particular part of it. And Helga stole just about everything I was going to talk about. So I have been mentally revising as I listened what I was going to talk about. So Helga, thank you for your remarks too. I was rereading Shakespeare's play Julius Caesar a week ago, and I came to those lines in Act 3, Scene 1, I believe, where a man who is setting his own destiny, committing suicide, essentially, Mark Antony, makes those famous words, whether he said it or not, is moot. Shakespeare said he said it. Cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war. That's a perfect way to describe what Helga in detail gave us in political terms, really, and what Dr. Postol gave us in scientific terms. We have decided in the American Empire to cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war. The dogs of war happen to be very sophisticated these days, as the last presentation demonstrated, and will destroy us all. And I'd like to take you back to 2002, when the first national security strategy came out that I think is still very relevant, because it was written by a lot of the people who are behind this and their descendants, if you will, who are still very much with us. And that security strategy, summed up in its essence, said the United States, the American Empire, will not tolerate any opposition in the world to its primacy at all. And when Secretary Powell and I talked about it, he was somewhat disturbed by some of the wording, but he wasn't as disturbed as I thought he should be. And when it boiled down to where I really wanted to impress upon him how disturbed I was, I said, do you realize that means that anyone, we're on the top of the mountain, boss. We're at the peak of the mountain. Cold War put us there because we want it. We're at the peak of the mountain. And if we see anyone stirring at the bottom of that mountain, a mouse, a rat, a beaver, anyone stirring at the bottom of that mountain, it doesn't matter what their intentions and capabilities are, which Dr. Postol referred to cleverly. Those are the two things you want to look at when you're assessing any enemy or potential enemy, is what are his capabilities and what are his intentions. And the latter sometimes is more important than the former. But this strategy said, if it stirs, we will kill it. Well, the first thing I said to the secretary was that means we are going to concentrate almost entirely on the military instrument. We are going to become, if we aren't already, a national security state. And if you want to know what a national security state is in microcosm, look at Israel right now. It is a national security state, and as long as it remains a Jewish state, it will be a national security state into the future until it is destroyed. What does that mean? That means that your entire intellectual capacity, your entire industry, your entire thought process is constantly aimed at, if not 24/7, close to that, the enemy, the people who might do you harm. And that's the reason I say Israel won't be a state much longer, not if it remains a Jewish state, because it will always have an enemy and Jews will not be very secure there, and therefore they will leave. Well, imagine the United States of America, probably in many respects, of the thousands of empires over the last two millennia or longer, the one with the most incredible capacity to do damage to the world. Imagine if it becomes a national security state. Oh, don't imagine it. We already are. We are a national security state. Our raison d'etre is our security. And that 2002 national security strategy said that in no uncertain terms. And we've been manufacturing the capabilities to go along with that strategy ever since. One of the reasons it frightens me as a soldier that this is happening is because I know the incredible deterioration of what I would call our conventional warfighting capabilities. And that means those things that you use to fight a war other than nuclear weapons. We're in dire straits right now, in many respects, in the conventional military. We're in dire straits partly because we have decided that we don't need it, and that decision has not been published for the American people to look at, except for proxy wars and brushfire wars. We don't need it in the defense of the United States because, bingo, we have nuclear weapons. Not only do we have nuclear weapons, but we are building out that complex associated with them at great profit to the niche military industrial complex that is associated with it. We're building it out to make sure that, as Dr. Postol's briefing sort of suggested, we can survive. And we hope that the old mantra of deterrence still works and that we will cow everyone in the world who is equipped with nuclear weapons, now nine states, so much so that we won't actually have to use them. My fear is that they are going to have to be used because we are going to, regardless of our disdain for conventional warfare and the instruments thereof, regardless of that disdain, we're going to get sucked into something that is initially conventional. And I can describe you scenarios in Taiwan and the South China Sea, scenarios elsewhere with China, and other scenarios that might be conducive to just that thing. Look at Ukraine, look at Israel today. I could see them going regional very rapidly, and at first without nuclear weapons use. But eventually, the dynamics of such a conflict, matched with that national security strategy that I just described to you, and the ethic and the thought process that accompanies it, will lead to nuclear weapons. And once again, the American Empire, as it was in 1945, will be the country to use nuclear weapons first. Because in that conventional struggle, which as in Ukraine and Israel might start out as a proxy struggle, in that struggle, once we start losing, which we most assuredly will, and bingo, footnote this, if we do what Bibi Netanyahu wants us to do and take on Iran in a serious way, that could be the very struggle I'm talking about that eventually will lead to nuclear use. And we will be the ones to use it first. I think that's one of the reasons distinctly lying behind the idea that Dr. Postol just briefly suggested to us in this trying to build this invulnerability into what we want to do with our nuclear weapons. It's not just for deterrence, it's also for warfighting. And to magnify and emphasize that, I am hearing for the first time since I read about it in the early 50s and all the way up to 62, 63, 64, I'm hearing military officers, high-ranking military officers, talk again about nuclear weapons in a fashion that they did at that time, that they do have utility, that they can be used. And then footnote that and think about missiles like the Russians have now, which they are now showing in Ukraine in brief episodes that go, they go 32,000 kilometers per hour. If you do the math, that's about 19,000 miles per hour. These are incredibly fast missiles. They cannot be shot down. There is no ballistic missile defense for these missiles. The one that just hit the facility in Ukraine that caused a big hoorah because it was a training facility is about a 4,500-mile-an-hour missile. These are incredible developments on that side of the field, as well as those that were expounded earlier on our side of the field. This is a very dangerous time. And as you've heard me say before, and I'll say it again here, we, the American Empire, no one else in the world, abrogated every single nuclear weapons regime treaty that we had so carefully crafted during the Cold War, to include the most successful one of all, one that eliminated an entire class of nuclear weapons, the most dangerous, in my view, the INF Treaty. We took them all out. And something we don't realize, too, is we took out the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty. Now, why would I say that in connection with nuclear weapons? Because CFE was very important in connection with the INF Treaty and other nuclear weapons treaties. The distance now between conventional weaponry that is so accurate, it has nuclear ground effects, if you will, on the battlefield, and nuclear weapons themselves, in actuality, is very thin. When we were watching the Russians in 2013 and 2014, fundamentally through the eyes of the Swiss and the Finns and the Norwegians who were observing their exercises, army size, corps size exercises, we found the reason they were building a doctrine that later became called escalate to de-escalate was because they feared NATO's possession of precision-guided munitions. Now, go back to Dr. Posol's presentations and you understand in a conventional sense why they were afraid. Because they thought the advantage NATO had in PGMs was so great that it had the impact of a nuclear weapon. By the way, we were saying that too. We were saying at one point that we didn't need tactical nuclear weapons anymore because PGMs would do the same thing when carefully concentrated. So their doctrine became, if NATO attacks the CSTO, the Collective Security Treaty Organization, then we will blunt that attack with a nuclear weapon, a small yield nuclear weapon, or two or three. And that's escalate to de-escalate, because they felt their disadvantage against NATO's PGMs was so significant that that's what they had to do. Now, that's evolved now, and Sergei Lavrov and Vladimir Putin have talked about this evolution. And incidentally, Putin was very, very dramatic when he said, our triad is better than your triad, trying to insinuate that if it were a nuclear war, it wouldn't be confined to Europe and it would be significantly detrimental to us as well as the rest of the world. All of this is going on now within the context of normality, of just this is the thing to do. This is what's necessary. And it's all fueled by, as I said before, the military industrial scientific think tank, you know, complex out there that makes lots of money. And incidentally, the nuclear weapons complex is a very niche-like complex that makes tons of money for very few people. So that's a motivator for this too. They don't want this complex to die. I saw their fear. Believe me, I saw their fear in 1991 and 92 when we were destroying Russian warheads so fast it'd make your head spin, and our own too, and going from some 30,000 warheads on both sides down to somewhere around 5,000 today, and with a full intent to go down to 1,200 on both sides. So it scared the bejesus out of the nuclear weapons complex, both those senators in Congress who protected it and those people at the labs and elsewhere who performed in it. So we have a huge problem in the American empire because we are letting slip the dogs of war, and the dogs of war are nuclear weapons. And there's nothing anymore to control those weapons other than the insane leaders of that empire. Thank you.
Thank you, Colonel Wilkerson. It's probably about time that we put a muzzle on these dogs of war. It's definitely gotten to the point where it's incredibly dangerous. Next, I'd like to introduce Colonel and Professor Wilfried Schäuber. He's a senior research fellow at Wildtrends Institute for International Politics in Potsdam. This is in Germany. So thank you so much for joining us, Colonel.
Thank you very much for the possibility to speak in front of you, because I feel, as a German, I feel as a person that is directly affected by this very real nuclear planning. This problem of the nuclear threat is accompanying me personally since my childhood. My birthplace is Dresden in the east of Germany. And that city, if you believe the military historians, was one of the first targets of the dropping of an American nuclear bomb. The Americans, at the end of the war, were not ready with the completion of the bomb. So Dresden only became a victim of a conventional attack in the February of 1945, which killed more than 25,000 Germans, citizens of the city. At the end of the war, I was 8 years old. So for me, this big war is a real remembrance and a memory, a vivid memory in my life until today. And it was, as a child, I felt the constant fear that you had throughout the day several times to crawl into the bomb shelter and get out again. Luckily, this fear was probably a very strong motive for me to become a soldier later in my life. And I was 35 years, I was a soldier. And the last 15 years as a professor, a high school professor in military academies. So I would never have thought that the Cold War would reemerge and that the threat of a nuclear war would reemerge hotter than ever before, would come upon us. The planned, I'm very shocked personally by the planning of the stationing of new American missiles starting with the year 2026 in Germany. I'm very concerned, and this is only affecting Germany. No other country has put upon itself this risk. We are going a special way, as Ms. Zeppler-Rusch has already said at the last meeting. For me, there are four reasons, essentially, that makes the situation so threatening, and why I principally are against the stationing of these systems in Germany. The first reason is 35 years have passed, and the technology that is now is 35 years more modern than then. We think about a situation which is completely new because of the new technologies that are being brought into the existence. These are missile systems that are in the hypersound and are very, very precise in their targeting capabilities. That means that the weapon systems and the command centers are targets. If you follow the military logic, you can only you can only avoid that by destroying them before they are being shot and fired. Personally, one must not become this military logic reality, because we need a new political logic. However, this is not in sight. And so I come to the second problem. We not only have more modern weapons and delivery systems, but we as a modern industrial nation are more vulnerable than ever before through the dependency on electricity. What happens if the lights go off and don't go on anymore? No water. No used water treatment, no warmth, no traffic. Nothing would work anymore, not even a gas station, no communication, no smartphone, no television, nothing. After 10 days, approximately, there would be complete chaos. In that regard, it's a very, very dangerous illusion to believe that a modern industrial society can be made war ready. It's an illusion. Just remember the destruction of Gaza. This was only done by conventional systems, bombs. For us, that we are potential targets, it doesn't matter. If nuclear war erupts, or conventional war, we are not war ready. We are not capable to conduct war. You cannot describe this as resilience or sustainability. Every war is destructive and deadly for an industrialized nation. May they be conventional or other systems.
Then I come to the third point. I can only make it short. There are no escalation stops. As people before me already hinted to it, that in the first Cold War, the control mechanisms of weapons are non-existent anymore. Between the nuclear powers, there is no coordination anymore. We have no network for critical situations to consult each other. The measures to build trust, which have been built up in 35 years, in a long period process, where the opponents came together, was given up on. And the only thing that is now there, we are at the beginning of a nuclear and also non-nuclear weapons arms race on steroids, basically. It's unimaginable what is just before us as a reality. And that leads me to my fourth point, which I think is especially bad. The Ukrainian decision to station rockets, which has not the German decision to bring the US rockets into Germany, which has not been a democratic process. No specialists, not a parliament, not the people have decided on that, have deliberated on that, but it was just one decision by the chancellor, where he agreed to that with the American president. So I can only say, this means that our democracy has failed. And there's no outcry, whether be it with the specialists or the parliamentarians, but also not with the people, with the population, which I find really astonishing. And it's really absurd that this has not been a NATO decision, which has decided upon during a NATO summit. So the people in the NATO Council have not discussed about that. I don't think that has happened. Maybe they have not agreed, but in the communique in the end, doesn't say anything about that. That is, in a certain sense, the tip of the iceberg of absurdity. No, that's the top of absurdity. So to conclude, the stationing of the new long-range missiles is for Germany and Europe, but also for Europe, threatens the existence and has to be stopped at any cost. I think we all should think about this new situation very thoroughly and think about what can we do. So we in Germany, I see that it's really urgent to work together over all parties in the peace movement, over all ideological or political borders, and to act together. When I see the polls in Germany, and therefore what the people think in the last weeks and months, we have a clear majority which is against this stationing. So therefore I can imagine that this already existing mobilization is enough to have a referendum as they do in Switzerland, then this might be stopped if we take it seriously. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Danke schön, Colonel Schäuble, for that. And I completely agree with you in unifying the peace movement. In fact, we want to work on getting many demonstrations going, especially in Germany, against this nuclear war policy. Thank you so much. Okay, so we will continue. Next, I'd like to have Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Bossart of the Swiss Armed Forces and consultant on military strategic affairs. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Bossart.
Thanks a lot for having me in your webinar today or tonight in Switzerland. Sitting-ish 30 k's away from the German border, I would like to focus on Germany and the impact of the recent decision on nuclear weapons for Germany as well. You know, when I was working for the Organization for Security and Cooperation, in Europe, in Vienna and in Ukraine, very much to my dismay, I had to observe how the arms control regime and the confidence and security building measures, the system of it, was dismantled. And in these years, I reminded the first days I started my training at the General Staff Academy of the Russian Armed Forces in Moscow in 2013, when I started to understand why the Cold War did not go hot. And what I'm observing today, of course, is not only worrying. It rings a bell, of course. It's not only worrying. It's even frightening. Because with the decision to station new medium-range weapons in Germany, the Biden administration and the government of Chancellor Scholz are once again creating a situation that we experienced in Central Europe in the 1980s, when NATO took its double track decision, which at the time offered the Soviet Union negotiations on controlling or even reducing nuclear weapons in Europe and even worldwide in parallel with rearmament. I think this was a tough decision for Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, particularly at the time, as I think Schmidt and his government were aware that this could create a volatile situation in which those involved in East and West, by the way, could be forced to make decisions under extreme time pressure, decisions that could have existential consequences. We must also be aware that there were fears at the time that the United States and the Soviet Union might agree not to let a regional nuclear exchange escalate into a global nuclear war, and at the end leave a devastated and nuclear irradiated Germany to its own devices. I learned from conversations with former officers of the National People's Army that such fears were not unknown in the German Democratic Republic either. Maybe Colonel Schreiber has conducted such discussions as well. The extremely short flight times of medium-range missiles also raised fears of a decapitation strike that could eliminate the leadership of the Soviet Union as part of a preemptive strike to destroy the Soviet Union's nuclear arsenal. Such decapitation strikes have also been attempted since then with conventional weapons, such as in the Operation Shock and Awe against Iraq in 2003, which was the prelude to a war against Iraq in violation, by the way, of international law. But don't get me wrong, I am not shedding tears for the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but this war has further weakened the UN Charter's ban on the use of force. Already during the Cold War, the Soviet Union used the perimeter system to protect itself from the decapitation of its political and military leadership. And a successor system is likely to be in use again today. And that might be a good answer to American think tanks that believe that a nuclear war can be fought and won. During the Cold War, the situation was simpler because the Soviet Union and the USA were the only superpowers, and the nuclear arsenals of other players in the world politics, namely of the United Kingdom, of France and China, were, to put it that way, they were manageable. Today, the number of players is higher, and the starting point for disarmament talks is more difficult than it used to be. In the 80s, we were spared a nuclear war, but in some cases, I think the smooth outcome of crisis hung by the proverbial thread. Today, the Biden administration and the Scholz cabinet are apparently prepared to take the same risks again, albeit without an offer to negotiate with the opponent and in a far more complex environment. I consider this as almost negligent, you know. The recipes of the Cold War will not work, especially as there is also a lack of platforms for talks. The OSCE, the organization which I've been working for years, was a way out of the Cold War in the 80s, but China today is not a participating state of the OSCE, and so such platforms would have to be created, and it takes time. And it takes definitely more time than the 6 or 7 minutes-ish that an intermediate-range nuclear missile needs to fly from Germany to Moscow. The refusal to make an offer of talks to Russia is in line with the West's current lack of concept on the issue of the Russian-Ukrainian war as well. The lack of concept was very much to my dismay demonstrated against at the conference in Switzerland, the famous Birkenstock conference in June. And it seems that the powers of the West are continuing their journey into a dead end. Federal Chancellor Scholz and Federal Defense Minister Pistorius have publicly stated that there's a capability gap in standoff weapons and it must be close in view of the Russian threat. Deterrence must be strengthened, they say, and attacks from a secure hinterland must be prevented from the outset in order to prevent the war, as they said. Scholz and Pistorius may overlook the fact that Russia nowadays considers NATO, especially NATO's allies in Western Europe that do not directly border on Russia, to be kind of a safe hinterland that has been able to afford to bring war to Russia's borders and coasts behind a shield of allies in Eastern Europe. In Russian eyes, I think NATO is nothing more than a safe harbor from which Western states pursue their geopolitical ambitions, be they the ones of the global players, such as the United States, be they the ones of the more regional ambitions of smaller NATO allies. The dismantling of arms control treaties and of the confidence and security building measures, the famous CSBMs that we were so proud of in the OSCE, must be seen in the context of the US shifting its focus to the Indo-Pacific region. With the INF treaty, the US did not have the right to build intermediate-range nuclear weapons, and China, not being a member, not being part of the treaty, did have such rights. And with the Open Skies Treaty, Russia had the right to carry out inspection flights over US territory, and Washington may have assumed in that Russia would pass on the findings to Beijing, of course. And on the other hand, the USA did not have the opportunity to carry out such inspection flights over China. So that was probably the reason why this contract had to go as well. I fully understand this all, but the victim of this development is Europe, which is now faced with literally nothing at a time of high tensions. So I think Europe should learn its lesson and not chain its security unconditionally to that of the global players, especially as it is losing global influence and is more in danger than ever before of ending up as a kind of a collateral damage in global fighting. There may be domestic political and geopolitical reasons why one of the most densely populated countries in Europe has been chosen to become a base for nuclear standoff weapons again. For one thing, I think the Biden administration is probably going around currently asking which country is prepared to station US nuclear weapons on its territory. But by the way, without having any say in the decision on the launch of such weapons, Finland has been apparently asked as well and was strong enough to refuse the Americans. Scholz was obviously not strong enough, probably mainly because he's under pressure from his own partners in the coalition and under pressure of parts of the of the opposition as well. And the geopolitical reason probably lies in the latent mistrust of its own allies towards Germany. With the end of the Cold War and the discussion about the future of NATO, fears arose in Eastern Europe that Russia and Germany could shape Eastern Europe in the future, if they got along with each other well, of course. Poland, the United Kingdom, and maybe to a lesser extent France, had to take a stand against this. For these countries, it is not enough that Germany is a NATO member. No, Germany should also be on Russia's nuclear target list so that it is not spared in the event of a war in Eastern Europe, which is going on now in Ukraine. And as long as Germany and Russia threaten each other with nuclear annihilation, the geopoliticians in Warsaw, London, Paris, and Washington can sleep peacefully. And the fact that the decision on the stationing of nuclear intermediate range weapons in Germany is or could turn out to be a test for cohesion in NATO, and obviously Chancellor Scholz and President Biden have decided to put NATO on the test, and I have my doubts whether that is what they wanted.
Okay. Well, I was told that I was going to be asked three questions, and I wonder what they are.
All right. Well, I will start out with one that I have. All right. Because we've had a panel, we've had an extensive discussion about the question of the present danger and sort of how we got here. There have been many different presentations, different aspects, and particularly our European guest, Professor Dr. Wilfried Schreiber, and Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Bossard of Switzerland, Dr. Schreiber from Germany, have given really insight into the, you know, what this looks like from the standpoint of people outside of the United States, which is an extremely important element. I guess I'll just ask you, just to get us started, because we had a video from you we did not show. We wanted to wait to see if we got you. Could you just give, from the vantage point of your experience, because you were there, you were at the time of the fall of the wall and then coming in for the Reagan administration and negotiating that situation, why is it that we have betrayed that understanding, and what has it meant for the world that the United States did not do what you and others attempted to do at that time?
Well, if you're speaking of the pledge not to expand NATO to the east, yes, I would say that my Secretary of State, Mr. Baker, and the German foreign minister, the British prime minister, they all gave assurances to Gorbachev if he would approve the merger of the two German states, that is the merger of the German Democratic Republic into West Germany, that there would be no expansion of NATO. At one point, Secretary Baker actually said, assuming there is no expansion of NATO, not one inch, wouldn't it be better to have a united Germany in NATO? And Gorbachev answered, well, obviously any expansion is not permissible, but he went on to say that he could understand the the reason we might want to keep NATO, even with a united Germany. Now, when it came to writing the treaties, this was not included in the formal treaties. These were, I would say, diplomatic promises. And I would say this promise was given on the background of a prior statement by President Bush, our first President Bush, who agreed in his meeting with Gorbachev in Malta that if the Soviet Union pledged not to use force in Eastern Europe to prevent political change, that is the democratization, and President Bush pledged that we would not take advantage of the democratization. So the background was pretty clear that Gorbachev felt he had assurances there would be no more expansion of NATO. Now, when the formal agreement was made, there was made an exception for the territory of the former East Germany, in that although it was allowed to be part of NATO, then but there could be no foreign troops or nuclear weapons stationed there, and that was formally in the treaty. So that now I think that, let me just add that for Russia, the problem has not been so much expansion of NATO. That is, the fact that the United States would, in effect, guarantee the security. What they have been most opposed to, and this was pointed out to us in the 1990s, was the stationing of American or other Western bases in these countries. So that we have to remember that President Putin actually did not object to the initial expansion of NATO. Well, he was not prime minister then, but the additional expansion to the three Baltic countries, when that was proposed, actually he was in New York at a meeting of the Council on Foreign Relations, I believe it was, and I asked him directly what he thought about the expansion of NATO into the three Baltic states. He said that, well, he thought that was unnecessary, but as long as there were no bases, he had no objection. Now, so the problem has been the combination. And then at the same time, it was very clear that there would be a difference in Moscow's attitude toward NATO, you might say, the countries in Eastern Europe and the Baltic states, and those that were former Soviet republics and recognized as Soviet republics by the United States and others. So that the idea of expanding NATO into, say, Georgia, Ukraine, or Belarus would have been a red line, I think, for any Russian president. And I must say that the Russian government did respect the borders that were agreed upon until the question of NATO expansion began, and the attempts by the Western powers, certain ones, to, I would say, to interfere in the politics of Ukraine. This was something that I think anyone who understands the history, which is very complex, of this, would understand that that was going to be resisted by the Russians. And none of this means that what has happened has been good, or that I would agree that it should have happened. But I think what we need to understand is that the expansion of NATO, and particularly the bases, and in this case, it was the bases that were planned in Poland and I believe Romania for anti-ballistic missiles. It turned out that although these were defensive weapons, the ones used could easily be converted to offensive weapons. So it was understandable that the Russian leader would be quite opposed. And yet we went ahead, and after progressively withdrawing from virtually every arms control agreement that we had negotiated in the 1980s and early 90s, and then we began to try to influence the Ukrainian government to offer NATO membership. So I think that this was a complete reversal of the diplomacy we used in the Cold War and to end the nuclear threats to Europe.
Okay. See, Helga has a question or a discussion. Please, Helga, go ahead.
Yes, Ambassador Medlock, I know it is difficult, you know, when history takes a wrong pathway, you cannot put it back. But I would nevertheless ask you, you know, what can be done to defuse this present situation, which is so extraordinarily dangerous? I mean, you said in the interview you gave us earlier that the atmosphere around the end of the Soviet Union was completely different than what people have in memory, that the Cold War did not end with the unification or even the end of the Soviet Union, but actually 2 years earlier. And there were a lot of ideas, including from Prodi, who basically had this idea of a united common house from Lisbon to Vladivostok. This was later picked up by several people, but when Putin mentioned it in the German Bundestag, he already was getting a cold shoulder. But, you know, given the fact that, you know, we are in a situation in Europe right now, there is no relationship between Russia and Germany, Russia and the United States. The trust level is at zero. But somehow we must find a pathway of rebuilding trust. I mean, we will be neighbors with Russia for the rest of the planet's existence, unless we move the tectonic plates in a different way. I mean, this is just the reality. So what, in your experience, what advice could you give to the present leaders who obviously, you know, would urgently need such advice? What should we do to get the world from the abyss and reconnect some kind of idea that diplomacy is the way to solve conflicts and maybe even have a vision of how to build a common security and development architecture which takes into account the interests of everybody?
Well, first of all, there are a lot of questions here, but the basic one I have tried to make actually in several books, none of which, by the way, have been published in German, but is that, number one, the Cold War did not end with a Western victory, as it is usually perceived. We negotiated it into the Cold War, which was a victory for everybody. And the end occurred because Gorbachev dropped the ideology which had fueled the Cold War. And he did that involuntarily so on. So now the Soviet Union then broke up. The Cold War had ended definitively 2 years before the Soviet Union broke up. The Soviet Union broke up not because of Western pressure and because it was defeated, but because of internal pressures of the nationalism in the various republics, and particularly the leadership of the Russian Federation president, Boris Yeltsin. So those who say that Russia is always imperialistic have a very short memories. Actually, Russia led the breakup of the Soviet Union, and the details are there. And I went through them in great detail on a book called Autopsy on an Empire, which I published around 1996. Now the thing is that this gave us the possibility that to develop a, I would say, a security structure for Europe that would include everybody. That is what Gorbachev expected and what he thought he was promised. The problem was that I think that if the first President Bush had been reelected, we would have developed that. I know that they had in mind that, but unfortunately, he lost that election. And the successor government seemed to be, although they were not the government that brought the end of the Cold War, to brag about, oh, we are the victors, and in effect, they were defeated. And the expansion of NATO, and then eventually the putting of military bases in Eastern Europe, I think was extremely ill-advised, because actually Russia at that time was in no way threatened any of these countries. But you begin to militarize them in an alliance that excludes Russia. And of course, Russia is going to see this as directed against it. All right, now you ask, what can we do now? I am not optimistic that anything can be done in the short run. It may take some catastrophe to bring us to our senses. The problem is, right now, in the United States, both political parties are really supporting what I think is a very dangerous policy. And those of us who want to emphasize peace are really a minority in both of those parties. And unfortunately, the American people are not paying attention to this. In this very active presidential election race, if you ask people what their concerns are, foreign policy maybe ranks about sixth or seventh, and only 4% of our population would put that at the top. In other words, we are fighting over issues which are, I would say, much less important. That means that actually, politically speaking, it's difficult for either candidate to espouse a coherent policy to turn away from totally from this. So I know that among other things, we're particularly worried about the possibility of the war in Ukraine going nuclear. And I think that obviously the sort of tensions that are being raised means that, and the fact that the sides seem to have nuclear weapons on, in effect, deployed and sometimes virtually on alert, that this is dangerous because of the ease in which a mistake could be made. I don't think either side right now is going to use them. And the fact is that President Putin has said that they would only use them if the existence of the Russian state came into question. I don't think we're near that point. But raising it, I think what we in the West or our governments ignore is that Russia and some of our other so-called adversaries have capabilities in other areas that match ours, particularly in cyber. and in the possibility, for example, of attacking communication satellites, which are essential for many of these weapons. And I think there has been really a great arrogance on the part of the U.S. and its NATO allies about our capability here, because the current policies are really not only dividing the world and inviting more violence, but also are actually strengthening those that we consider our adversaries in many respects. But in any event, in the short run, I don't see the possibility, you know, of a sudden change. It's going to have to be gradual. And I would also say these problems in Europe, the war in Ukraine, we have to remember there's also a war going on in the Middle East. And in fact, that is involving what I think by any definition is genocide. And I am ashamed that that genocide is being carried out by weapons supplied by the United States. If you ask why, I would say because of our domestic politics, because the pressure to do that has been very great. And but that is a big issue. And then when we look at policies in the Far East, the attempt, quote, to contain China and to, in effect, warn that we would defend Taiwan if it should be attacked, raises the possibility of a war there. And again, one with a country with nuclear weapons. And when I look out at that as an American, and right now, I think primarily of American interests, I find great dangers. I believe the United States, in the obligations we have taken on, because defending another country, the guarantee is a liability. That's insurance. It is not an asset. And we are grossly overextended, and the United States has been paying for all these wars since we invaded Iraq, borrowing funds and borrowing largely from other people. We now have debts of over, I think, $33 trillion. And the chairman of our Federal Reserve Bank has said this is unsustainable, but there is no plan being discussed politically that's going to change it, because everything both candidates are saying now, they're going to cut taxes. They're going to continue these deficits. Pretty soon, that's going to become unsustainable. But it's very hard for me to predict when that will happen. But I, in as much as in the United States, and I think in some other countries, our most prominent media seem to be simply mouthpieces for those who are following these grossly mistaken policies.
Ambassador Matlock, I'm going to request that President Donald Ramatar ask the final question for you. He, of course, president of Guyana, former president of Guyana. He represents a person that governed a nation, not a superpower, but which represents the vast majority of humanity that often are incorrectly reduced to spectators when it comes to global policymaking discussions and decisions. I thought that since he both ceded this time, which was very good, and he represents that global majority, that you get a chance to pose the last observations if you have more time to stay with us. Great, but I wanted to at least give him the opportunity to address you. We can't hear you. Could you unmute?
You hear me now?
Yes, you're fine.
First of all, I would like to say how happy I am to to see Mr. Matlock speaking and so forth. I always admired him. I read a lot of his work. My question to him would be, how much of this, what is happening today, would he put to the whole question of the deterioration of the quality of leadership in the West at this point in time?
Well, obviously, I'm very much disappointed with the decisions that have been made. And I think it's going to take probably some at least minor catastrophes to begin to bring people to their senses. I just hope it's minor and not major. I mean, I think we're seeing enough catastrophes already, but there is still too much attempt to try to solve problems by using military force or economic compulsion. And these measures tend to backfire. And also, I believe that we are facing real problems for humanity, even aside from, you might say, the threat of nuclear weapons, in the deterioration of the environment, global warming and the changes that will bring, because obviously we are facing now an increasing problem to deal with global warming, which may reach stages which cannot be reversed. And that is going to require or stimulate widespread migrations for economic reasons. We already see the political problems of these migrations because of war and environmental degradation are bringing about on the political structure of our various countries. So I do think that in the final analysis, I do hope that our political establishment will wake up. And you cannot actually at the same time, seems to me, try to restrain global carbon dioxide emissions while you are dropping 2,000-pound bombs on Gaza. I mean, these wars are obviously counteracting almost anything we're trying to do on global warming. And of course, that is, I would say, one of the greatest dangers facing the next two or three generations. I will not live to see the results of these, but I really worry about my grandchildren.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yes, yes. And you're welcome to come back anytime. So.
Okay, thanks very much. I really enjoyed the presentation. I think everyone was very, very important in the presentation. I would like to just say that our world is being divided in two in front of our very eyes, into two major blocks as we speak. On the one hand, the struggle of the former colonial powers joined now and led by the United States are waging wars and stoking aggression in various parts of the world in order to continue their domination of the world. The two most dangerous dangers are the struggle in Russia-Ukraine, correctly characterized as a US-NATO proxy war against Russia, reaching a very dangerous stage. The continued escalation by the NATO forces in providing more and more offensive weapons and providing mercenaries and providing intelligence to the Zelensky regime could easily spin out of control. It seems to me that the collective West, that is NATO and European Union, are daring Russia, almost forcing it to take more action against one of their states. I need not elaborate to this audience where this can take us: mutual destruction. The second very dangerous hotspot is the Middle East. Once more, we see that that region would never be in peace unless the issue of the Palestinian people's rights to self-determination, a right enshrined in the Charter of the United Nations, is realized. The fact that the Israeli forces have now expanded has exposed the real intention and the behavior of the regime. They expanded to the West Bank, which is to grab land. Their main idea is to grab land, all the Palestinian land. And the idea that it's using terror could create an exodus of the Palestinian people. That is their hope. All of this is only possible because of the support provided by the collective West, particularly the United States. Israel has historically been used by the United States as a gendarme in the Middle East. Over the years, the United States managed to remove all the other powers that could act to balance their own power, like the USSR, or that can easily be an honest broker. The US is in sync with Israel to expel Palestinians. Recall that at the very beginning of this conflict, of Israel assault, the United States did everything to prevent a ceasefire. They used their position in the United Nations along with many of the NATO allies to give Israel a free hand to destroy the very foundations of the Palestinian society. Their targets were people's homes, 80% of them destroyed, essential services, water, electricity, hospitals, schools. Aid workers are being killed, UN workers are being killed, journalists are being killed, babies and children and women are being destroyed. The US moved massive military assets in the Middle East to prevent any state in the region or beyond from going to the assistance of the Palestinian people. In a nutshell, it was to give Israel a free hand to commit genocide. In response to world opinion, it began talking about ceasefire, but have continued to keep Israel well supplied with the most modern weapons, more than 500 military planes with all bombs, and more than 107 ships taking weapons. Some 500,000 tons of military equipment were given to Israel in this period, apart from the $4 billion a year in military help that is being given. This is a fight. This is to fight a people with hardly any weapons. In most of the NATO states, dissent is now being stamped out. Protests, journalists are being harassed and jailed. Protesters are being jailed. They are now trampling on their own concept of liberal democracy. I propose that we should not be discouraged. Those of us who must continue to encourage and organize mass protests, we should try to lift the campaign to another level. We must call for the suspension of the fascist apartheid regime from Israel, from the United Nations. I think that this should be a new call that we should make. We must urge all governments to make this call. And this is very important, taking into consideration the experience with South Africa. South Africa was suspended from the United Nations when they were stiffening their back against the international calls for the end of apartheid. Clearly, we have a crisis. Colonel Lawrence Wilkinson spoke about some of these crises, a crisis in leadership in the West, in my view. On every global issue, Western leadership is failing us terribly. We just heard Mr. Matlock speaking about the environmental issue, and nobody has been speaking. We were only speaking about cutting forests. But what is the cost to the environment of wars? For this reason, I wish to support the idea proposed by Helga to form a body of reason, of rationality, to try to establish or to offer an alternative to what is taking place. And I believe that these meetings are making a big contribution to that. On the other hand, you have right now taking place simultaneously with what is happening in China, African countries going there looking for developmental issues and China being a great partner in that development. I don't want to elaborate in the question of time, but I will see that this is a stark focus on the one hand of one set of leadership in the West, stoking war in every corner of the globe, conflict, and preventing solutions like in the South China Sea, etc. And on the other hand, there's another set of leadership that is trying to create prosperity for all so that we can have better relationship and relieve the tension, linking democracy, linking the development with peace and democracy. I thank you for your attention.
I think I can only hope that the program we produce today will be distributed widely around the world. And I would appeal to all of you to help do that using all lists and channels and platforms you have, because I think if we would be able to get an audience of, let's say, tens of millions of people, I think it would make a difference. So I'm asking you to help to do that. I think also the need to go into the streets rapidly is also important. We have the 26th, what you said, Anastasia, the 28th, Kurt Ritter rally, Rage Against the War rally, the October 3rd, big demonstration planned in Berlin. This is the National Day of Unification, and a lot of groups are calling for it. But I just think we need to really organize everybody to make the governments understood that they cannot do what they wish over the heads of the people. And, you know, in the 80s, this did help a lot to contribute to an environment in which the INF Treaty was made possible. However, I think that is not good enough, because the underlying reason of the conflict is, on the one side, the pending threatening collapse of the transatlantic financial system, sitting on the $33 trillion US debt, but furthermore, $2 quadrillion outstanding derivatives, which could be detonating every moment. And then secondly, that the real cause and the change in the strategic doctrines in the US, which was then accompanied by a uniform blasting of Russia and China by all the transatlantic think tanks, which really started in 2017. The reason being the rise of China and the rise of the BRI, where China extended the Chinese economic model to other developing countries. And for 4 years, the West did not notice that. We followed this very clearly because, as you or some of you may know, the Eurasian land bridge was our design for a peace order in 91 when the Soviet Union collapsed. And a lot of what China is doing now are in affinity what my late husband and our movement did for half a century. So therefore, you don't solve the problem by just making a new defense treaty or disarmament treaty or any such thing. You have to address the root causes, which means you have to have a change in the paradigm. And, you know, I think we can become friends again with not only the Russians, but also every other country in the world or people in the world, if we consider that we are the one humanity, that, you know, whatever historical and ethnic and other divisions may separate us, we must make the jump to first think about the interest of humanity as a whole and then go to our national interests. So in a certain sense, you know, it's the opposite of America first, America second, or America in line with humanity first. And I think that mental jump has to be made. And I think we need to address the conflict, you know, what President Ramata said, the world is falling into two blocks. That should not happen. We have to have a situation where the United States and European nations stop this geopolitical nonsense and basically say, we cooperate with the global majority. if the countries of the global south are now finally, after 600 years of colonialism, intending to build their own system which allows for their economic development, we should not fight it, we should support it. If you want to deal with the migrant crisis, be it at the border between Mexico and the United States, or if you don't want the Mediterranean turning into a mass grave, well, then help to create 2 billion, 3 billion productive jobs in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, and all the people will happily build their own economy and overcome poverty, which is a violation of human rights, if I ever have seen one. Because if you are poor, you know, if you are trying to have one meal a day and you don't know if you have one for tomorrow, your human rights are violated in no way, because you're being deprived of the most important, which makes us human, which is our creative potential, which we can only unfold and develop if we have the basic material needs to do so. So therefore, I have proposed that we need a new security and development architecture which addresses the interests of all people on the planet, all nations on the planet. And I have proposed 10 principles which could be the ingredient for the beginning of a discussion how such an architecture could look like. And what Suzanne Schwartz said fits perfectly in there. And I think we should really, you know, move towards solutions, because I think if we only protest the negative, it will not be sufficient. We have to come up with constructive resolutions and therefore help us build the IPC, join us, triple 10 times as many next week, and keep organizing with this program. Thank you.